Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Market rate, £3,000 a day. Were you signing Lionel Messi? This is First Minister's Questions. Just once, it would be nice to get a First Minister's answer.
For Douglas Ross to stand there and talk about losing grip of a party when he has been leader, Conservatives have had the longest attempted coup in Scottish political history.
The Steenie, a politics podcast from The Scotsman. Hello and welcome to The Steamy, The Scotsman's politics podcast. I'm Alistair Grant, The Scotsman's political editor, and this week we'll be discussing a shock update in the never-ending saga involving the Ferguson Marine Shipyard in Port Glasgow, as well as new legislation aimed at legalising assisted dying in Scotland. Me and Rachel Amory, The Scotsman's political correspondent, will be talking to Liam MacArthur, the Liberal Democrat MSP behind the new legislation, later on in the podcast to hear about the background to his plans and why he thinks the political momentum now favours a change in the law to help those who are terminally ill and mentally competent to end their lives. But first, this week we had the surprising news, I think it's fair to say, that David Tideman, the chief executive of the Ferguson Marine Shipyard, has been fired by the board. Ferguson Marine, of course, at the centre of a long-running row over the delivery of two Calmac ferries, which are now hugely delayed and over budget. The background to the latest move, which I think it's fair to say came as a shock to almost everyone, is the expectation of yet more delays, in this case to Glen Sannox, the vessel due to be completed in June, I believe. I feel like I've been writing and talking about this for a long, long time, but if I feel like that, I dread to think how the person I'm about to be joined by feels. I'm delighted to say that Alistair Dalton, the Scotsman's legendary transport correspondent, is here on the Steamy to shed some light on the saga. How's it going, Alistair?
Hi there from the Glasgow office.
I suppose the obvious question is, why was Mr. Tideman sacked? And what is some of the background to this decision?
Yes, as you say, it came completely out of the blue, and I had to read that press release several times for it to sink in properly, because it was just against all the signs that we'd had from up to now. However, looking back at it sort of a day after it happened, there was a perhaps writing on the wall with increasing impatience by Scottish government ministers. Neil Gray, who was the wellbeing economy secretary in charge of the yard, was talking back in December when there was yet another delay about his extreme concern at the situation. And then in response to, as you say, expected further delays to these ferries, his successor, Mary McCallan, talked about that being unacceptable. So he's been very, very blunt about it. They're impatient, but I'm not sure they're doing much more than kind of shooting the messenger. And it looks like this could just create more uncertainty, another perhaps hiatus while the interim chief executive takes over. And then I imagine they're going through a process of they'll have to appoint a permanent chief executive, who'll be the fourth in just around 5 years.
And have you got any sense of what the feeling is behind the scenes about this as to, you know, how this has affected morale, if it's a sense of yet more change at a yard that has gone through quite a lot?
Yeah, well, the workforce will say they'll keep on with doing what they're doing under the new regime, and the union is very, the GMB is very keen to say it's not the workforce's problem and it's not David Tideman's problem. It's really the management and the workers picking up the pieces for an extraordinary way in which these ferries started to being built 6 years ago. David Tideman has talked about just an example of what they're up against. He, when the Scotsman, we visited Glen Sannox a year ago, he was producing some analogies about what had gone wrong that they were uncovering and having to fix. He says, a bit like you're building a new kitchen and you're putting up the cupboards, but you haven't plastered the walls behind them. So it's just fundamental errors. As far as reaction from others, I mean, there's an element of disbelief, even amongst those organisations working closest with the shipyards. So you've got the Scottish government-owned ferry buying company called Caledonian Maritime Assets Limited, CMAL. And they're pointedly thanking David Tideman for his work. They told me that this is the first chief executive at the yard they could actually sort of see eye to eye with and agree with on delivery dates and so forth. So very few people, aside from ministers, coming out to say this is the right decision.
And what do you think will happen next in terms of, you know, I suppose, what next for the future of the yards and what next for the future of these two ferries that have been at the centre of so much political kind of scandal in Scotland? As I say, it feels like we've been talking about this for a very long time.
Yeah, and I've confidently predicted that they will be completed by such and such a date, and then that slips yet again. And I think we're in a situation where it's so near yet so far. So Glen Sannox, the first of the two, that's now completed its initial sea trials, and it seems to do really well. It's going into dry dock in a few weeks' time for some further work, and we don't know yet whether there'll be further delays, but currently, as you mentioned, it's due to be completed in June. It'll need 2 months of trials by CalMAC, and then it will be put in service just as soon as they can get it, possibly later this summer. And this is on the main Arran route to Brodick, which is CalMAC's busiest. Now, David Tyme, before he left, really talked up how good a ferry this will be. It's one of their biggest. And on the basis that its sea trials have done really well, it could be that people will think, wow, this is a great vessel. And they finally started to turn the corner. Now, with the second vessel, Glen Rosa, which is launched in just a couple of weeks' time, that was far less complete when David Tideman took over. So there should be less to go wrong. And just an example, this will be launched when it's 800 tons heavier than Glen Sannox was infamously launched in 2017 with those painted on windows and so little done. So it should be a smoother, I should say that, but I'm being a hostage to thought. It should be smoother to get Glen Rosa done. But as far as the future is concerned, well, when these two ferries are completed, they have got this blank order book. They're doing a little bit of work for the Royal Navy with the new frigates at BAE Systems in Glasgow, but really relatively small beer. They want to get more, but they need extra money from the government to improve things at the yard. I mean, David Tideman talked about it's not just a case of his predecessors not knowing how to build a ferry. They didn't seem to know how to run a shipyard. All the equipment's in the wrong place, cranes are installed incorrectly, the buildings are just not efficient. So they'll need money from the Scottish Government to put all that right so they can compete for other work. And one thing they're really hoping to get is the next ferries from CalMAC, smaller vessels, very similar to ones that they built very successfully, as CMAL have endorsed them on that. And it's unlikely they'll be allowed to get a direct order because there's international regulations which prohibit that. But they will be looking to compete to get that order. So that's the key thing. But the Scottish government keep putting things back there, and we don't know when that's going to happen.
Well, it's been an extraordinary saga, and I'm sure we've not heard the end of it. But thank you very much, Alistair. Thanks for talking us through that. But away from ferries and onto something else entirely, and that is the news that Liam MacArthur has formally introduced his legislation to legalise assisted dying in Scotland for the terminally ill and mentally competent. As I say, me and Rachel Amory have caught up with Liam MacArthur to hear more about his plans. And we're here in the office of Liam MacArthur, the Liberal Democrat MSP, whose bill to legalise assisted dying for the terminally ill and mentally competent has been officially introduced and published today. Liam, it'd be probably quite useful for you to explain exactly what your bill does and what safeguards it contains.
Well, it's built on a terminal illness mental capacity model that we've seen introduced in states and countries around the world, initially in the state of Oregon in the United States, subsequently in around a dozen further states in the US, and more recently in Australia and New Zealand. It would provide that access to an assisted death for somebody with an advanced progressive terminal illness and capacity to make the decision around assisted death. It would require two doctors to make that diagnosis of terminal illness and mental capacity. But the doctor would also seek to understand the rationale, the motivation behind it, in order to ensure that there hasn't been undue pressure or coercion applied, and also to talk through the range of options that may be available, including palliative care, hospice care and the like, to make sure that the decision being made is an informed one. There would be a residency requirement of 12 months. An individual would have to have been resident in Scotland and registered with a GP practice. There'd also be a waiting period of 2 weeks from the point at which the application for an assisted death was made to when any medication could be applied. So those are the sorts of safeguards, as I say, that we've seen implemented safely and successfully in jurisdictions around the world. And no two systems are the same, no two laws are the same, but broadly speaking, that terminal illness model is one that has proven successful, as I say, over recent years.
What prompted you to do this? Why did you think this was an important bill to bringing forward?
I've been a long time supporter of a change in the law. I remember sitting in on a members business debate that was being led by my former colleague Jeremy Purvis, who sought to bring forward his own bill back in, I think, the second session of Parliament. He couldn't secure support in order to introduce the bill, but as a result, I think, of listening in and participating in that debate, Margot MacDonald decided she wanted to bring forward a bill, and obviously we had that process leading up to the vote in 2010, and then subsequently her second bill that Patrick Harvey picked up and we voted on in 2015. Throughout that process, I've supported those attempts to change the law, and it's brought about, I think, by a recognition that the ban on assisted dying is leaving a small but significant number of Scots in an intolerable position at the end of life, and despite the best efforts of palliative care, they are enduring difficult, protracted and often painful deaths. We know that those who have the financial means and the physical capacity have the option of going to Switzerland to access the services provided by Dignitas. But for many more, we know that either they endure this bad death or they take matters into their own hand, either refusing food and liquids or else taking even more drastic action. And that is hugely traumatic, both for them, but particularly for those that they leave behind, whose abiding memory is those final days, weeks, and the way in which their loved one passed away.
You're mentioning the few other times it's come to Parliament, because this is now, I think, the third time that the bill's officially come forward. Why is it so much more popular now? The front page of The Scotsman on the Thursday that this has been published was a survey saying that 78% of the public are in favour of this. So why do you think it's changed so much this time around?
Well, I think the public support has always been there. Even thinking back to 2015, that there was pretty overwhelming public support even then. That's been around, I would say, for best part of the last two decades. I think the intensity of that support has increased. I think it matters more to people. I think that broadly reflects the fact that the more and more people have a personal experience of losing a family member or a close personal friend in very difficult circumstances, and it's brought home to them why a change in the law is needed, that the ban on assisted dying is failing too many terminally ill Scots. I think one campaigner once suggested to me recently that everyone is one bad death away from supporting assisted dying. So that public support has been pretty solid for some time now. We see it now across every part of the country. I think what's different now is that's translating into greater political support. I think the political mood is changing, and it's catching up with where the public have been for some time. Some of that is due to seeing legislation successfully implemented in other jurisdictions around the world. Some of it is to do with I think the shift in opinion within the medical community. We see the BMA and a number of the Royal Colleges moving from a position of opposition last time to neutrality. They'll be challenging, I know, they'll have issues on the part of their members, but that position of neutrality, I think, is not insignificant. And I think very many MSP colleagues themselves have a personal experience of losing a loved one in difficult circumstances. And that is shaping and influencing the way in which they approach this debate.
There are high profile figures, Humza Yousaf, Anas Sarwar, who always say that they are yet to be persuaded by this. I think Humza Yousaf very recently saying he's not convinced by it. How are you going to go about persuading those people?
I think I need to realise that I won't be able to persuade all of my MSP colleagues. I'm confident I can persuade a majority of them to back the principles of the bill. But I've had a number of conversations with Humza Yousaf over the last year or so, in fact, back to the time when he was then Health Secretary. I think by his own admission, he's been on a bit of a journey, but he isn't persuaded. I think if the bill were to be voted on today, he would undoubtedly vote against it. There's a challenge for me to try and allay the concerns that he has and other colleagues have. I will be successful in many instances, but I know that there are those who have concerns that I will not be able to allay and who will not be supportive of the bill. But I think what is interesting is that this is a debate that cuts across party political divisions. There are many within Humza Yousaf's party, including around his cabinet table and in his ministerial team, who have been long-term advocates of a change in the law, many of his backbenchers as well, who in a sense have led the have been leading the campaign, similarly in the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, as well as Greens and Liberal Democrats. That, I think, is a strength of the issue, strength of the campaign. But another, I think, aspect of the debate is that it is genuinely and generally been conducted in a pretty respectful and measured fashion. And that, I think, is to the credit of both those who are supportive and opposed and the very many colleagues who are undecided or conflicted. And I look forward to continuing in a similar vein over the coming months and in an attempt, to persuade a majority of my colleagues to support the general principles.
I wanted to ask you as well about comments by Pam Duncan-Glancy, the Labour MSP, who is a wheelchair user, and she's warned in the past that legalising assisted dying would be dangerous for disabled people, and she's far from alone in having those kind of fears. Well, what do you say to her and others who are worried about the impact on disabled people?
Again, Pam is somebody I've been able to have various conversations with over the recent times, and I genuinely respect her, not just in terms of the issue she prosecutes on behalf of the disability community, but more generally, she is an enormously powerful advocate. She's probably somebody I wouldn't necessarily be expecting to change their views on this issue, but the engagement I've had with her has been incredibly useful for me in better understanding the root cause of the concerns that she has. I think genuinely that point that she and others make about the way in which society doesn't value the lives of many of those in the disabled community is spot on. I have some personal experience of that, albeit at a removed distance. And I understand that. I think this debate can expose some of those issues, but it can't resolve them. And ultimately, the only way of accessing an assisted death under the bill I've introduced to Parliament is if somebody has an advanced progressive terminal illness and mental capacity. Having a disability wouldn't be a criteria that would allow access to an assisted death. However, if a disabled person had a progressive and advanced terminal illness and capacity and had chosen an assisted death, I see no reason why they should be denied it. I think that would be wholly unacceptable. And all the polling suggests that actually within the disabled community, the level of support for a change in the law in this area is every bit as strong as it is in the population as a whole.
If we go through just a few of the other points that some people have raised as being potential issues coming forward with this, if we go with age, first of all, now remind me, is it 16 that it's proposing from? So if there's a young person who's 15 turning 16, let's say, and they do have a terminal diagnosis, Is that too young? Are they too young to be making that kind of decision?
I think there'll need to be a genuine debate around this. I opted for 16 in my bill, age of majority, but I fully expect this to be an area that the lead committee taking evidence will want to scrutinise. I've had discussions with a range of different stakeholder organisations, including CHAS, who I know have concerns about age limits. So I'm open to having those discussions. I need to, I think, understand the nature of the concerns and how they might be addressed. But in a sense, what we're talking about here is a process that allows for far more open, regulated and safeguarded discussions around how we die. And I think that is to be welcomed. I mean, it will allow a discussion around palliative care, which we may come on to cover. But having those discussions about how we die and improving the quality of death, I think are absolutely invaluable. We spend an awful lot of time in this Parliament discussing how we improve the quality of life. We don't spend nearly enough time talking about how we improve the quality of death. And so some of the discussions my bill opens up, I think will shine a light on those issues.
What about some of those with mental health issues? You know, for example, if someone is terminally ill but suffers from depression, would they qualify?
I think about part of the capacity assessment is not a general capacity. It is a capacity to make the decision around an assisted death, and therefore a medical professional would need to satisfy themselves that there wasn't an issue there that was impeding that capacity. If there was any concern around it, either of the two doctors that would need to make the diagnosis could make a referral to a specialist. And those are the sorts of assessments that medics are making pretty routinely in relation to a range of procedures. So I think it's a concern that I understand. It needs to be reflected in the debate that we have. If there are other things that can be done in terms of improving the safeguards, I'm certainly open to hearing what those might be. Although, as I say, if you look at the jurisdictions where a terminal illness mental capacity model has been introduced, neither is there any expansion in those criteria, and those sorts of issues around mental health are treated sensitively and I think very effectively.
You mentioned earlier about palliative care, so you're right, that is one of our questions today. There has been a survey done of palliative care doctors, and I think it was about 95%, it was a very vast majority, said that they wouldn't want to be prescribing this or carrying out this procedure themselves, and they have worries about how funding will happen for palliative care as well. What's your responses there?
Well, I think a number of points to make there. I probably wouldn't expect those in the palliative care sector to be in the vanguard of campaigning for a change in the law around assisted dying. I think that that would be unlikely. I think what we've seen in terms of jurisdictions around the world is that those that come to it with a degree of anxiety, once they see it operating in practice, are reassured that it can be and is safely protected using the safeguards I've talked about. I think the debate within the palliative care sector as well is a bit more nuanced than that. I think in a sense what they want a reassurance around is in a sense that the relationship that they have with the patients that they're caring for. And I entirely understand that. But in a sense, what we've seen around the world is a medical profession who have very legitimate questions. I talked earlier about various organisations moving from a position of opposition to neutrality. That neutrality doesn't mean that they will not be very challenging in the questions that they ask, and that's right and proper. So if there are more things we can do to provide that reassurance, I'm all for trying to address that. I think some of that, though, may come through in terms of secondary legislation and guidance that will provide the training and the support, etc., that those in the palliative care sector absolutely need to have.
Are you worried at all about having enough doctors who are willing to carry this out? Because I mean, there is a big difference between supporting it and actually being the person to actually carry this procedures out. Are you worried about that at all?
Again, I can't see any reason why that would be a problem in Scotland in a way that we haven't seen it being a problem in any of the other states and jurisdictions and countries where it's been introduced. As I say, I think there would need to be a lead-in time prior to the introduction to make sure that medical professionals do feel comfortable with the role they're being asked to perform. But the numbers that would be involved in this, in terms of the number of patients coming forward asking for an assisted death, are going to be relatively small. I mean, they're a small number, but a significant proportion of the terminally ill. And therefore the number of medical professionals that would be actively involved in this process is likely, again, to be relatively small. Now, I appreciate that beyond that, there will be those that that are impacted by it. They may be not directly involved, but will feel that they need reassurance. But as I say, I don't see there's any reason why the medical profession in Scotland would be any less willing to engage in this process, subject to, I think, a conscientious objection that would allow those who really, whether for faith reasons or whatever, would have the opportunity to exempt themselves, albeit with the requirement that they'd be expected to signpost the patient to somebody who could actually provide the support they were looking for.
One of the arguments you often hear in this debate is this idea of a slippery slope. This is opening up a potentially dangerous can of worms and, you know, affecting all sorts of kind of deep existential questions about the value of life. What do you make of that, the argument that to go down this road in the first place is dangerous?
Well, as I say, I think what we've seen in all of the jurisdictions where a terminal illness mental capacity model has been introduced, there has been no extension of the eligibility criteria over the years. There's no two laws around the world that are identical. But there are two broad models. There is the terminal illness mental capacity model, first introduced in Oregon in the late 1990s, subsequently rolled out in a number of a dozen or so states in the US and more recently in Australia and New Zealand. That is the model I'm looking to introduce here in Scotland. There is then a more expansive, permissive model that's been in place for some time in the Netherlands and Belgium and more recently in Canada. And while there'd been no expansion of the criteria in the terminal illness model, there's been no retrenchment from the more permissive models into a terminal illness model. So those circumstances, I think each legislature needs to decide what is the approach that commands public support in their countries and their states. There's been no example of a law introduced that's then been repealed, and I think all the polling evidence in those countries and states suggests they command strong public support. So I think we can learn the lessons from those international examples, but we will need to find a way forward on this that meets our needs and circumstances. But again, I think the House of Commons Health Committee in a report published last month after an 18-month inquiry on these issues recognised and came to the conclusion that there really is no evidence of the so-called slippery slope.
Well, I'm sure this is an issue we'll be hearing a lot about in the coming months. Is there any kind of expectation as to when this law would be passed if it did manage to get through Holyrood?
I think in terms of managing people's expectations about when I was going to be in a position to introduce it, I think my credibility on making those sorts of projections is shot to pieces. I'm very conscious that there are those out there and amongst the public who are desperate to see this law change, particularly those with a terminal illness or who are caring for somebody with a terminal illness. But the sensitivity, the complexity of these issues absolutely demands that Parliament exercises its scrutiny function robustly and thoroughly. I have every confidence it will do that. It will go to a lead committee. We will take written and then oral evidence before coming up with a stage one report that then MSPs will vote on, in a sense, on the general principles of the bill. That's where the previous two bills obviously foundered. I hope that now with the shift in the political mood that we'll get beyond that and we'll get into the task of amending the legislation, ironing out issues where colleagues have concerns. The sooner that happens, the better, but we cannot cut corners with this. Needs to be taken to do the due diligence on it to make sure that what we come up with is legislation that's fit for purpose.
Yeah, so an understandably lengthy and detailed process ahead. Yeah. But Liam McArthur, thanks very much for your time.
Very welcome.
That was Liam McArthur, the Liberal Democrat MSP, whose bill to legalise assisted dying for the terminally ill was published on Thursday. But that's all we've got time for this week. Thank you very much for tuning in, and please join us again next week.